For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
The sort of theme, if there is one, is that I want to talk about the context of our practice, both in sort of a narrow sense and in a broader sense. And the occasion of this is indeed the occasion of my being here talking this morning, in the sense that I'm here because our teacher, Tygon, is in Washington, D.C. this morning with many thousands of other people and will be engaging in demonstrations urging the leaders of our country to give careful consideration to the completion of this Keystone XL pipeline that we've all been hearing about. In fact, they'd like it not to be completed. And I think that there's something to be learned simply from the fact that that's happening. And I think this is one of the ways that Tygon functions very effectively as a teacher. Perhaps I can speak only for myself. Speaking for myself, his willingness to be an activist and his his willingness to engage in critical thought and to engage us to engage in critical thought make him I suppose all Zen teachers are special in their way, but these are qualities that I very much appreciate in him and are very important to why he's my teacher and not somebody else. So that said, and this says something about the context of practice. What is our practice about? And I've got two kind of quotes that I'm going to sort of try and weave this talk around. The first one is, and I'll talk about them separately, is from the Precious Mirror Samadhi. It's a text that we chant here often and we'll be talking about as part of our practice commitment period that's coming up, which there'll probably be an announcement about. But it's a line that, shall we say, does not go down easily for me in the context of this poem about samadhi, basically. And it goes like this. Ministers serve their lords. Children obey their parents. Not obeying is not filial. Failure to serve is no help. Not obeying is not filial. Failure to serve is no help. Well, obviously, this comes out of a sort of a Confucian context that no longer particularly applies to our situation in any direct sense. And I hear these, as a child of the 60s, I hear these things like, obey and serve. And, I have a bit of a aversive response, shall we say, to them. But I think what's so interesting about the fact that this line appears in a poem about samadhi is that it says something about, as I say, the context of our samadhi, the art of our zazen practice, which is that it's not for ourselves, but it's not exclusively for ourselves. Our practice is for all beings. And when we look at this line, these lines, in that context, obeying, not being filial, obey has, I looked it up, and it's, complying to commands or instructions. So You know, in a teaching context, I mean, in a Zen context, I can certainly see, yeah, you know, if Taigen makes recommendations to my practice, about my practice, I will, you know, definitely listen to them and do my best to explore them. Filial. Such an interesting word. Not one that we use a lot. And in the immediate sort of setting of this poem, you know, in this sort of Confucian sort of worldview, you know, they're talking about very sort of determinate relationships that any person has with a, with everybody else. So there's master-servant, you know, or lord-retainer, that kind of relationship. There are husbands and wives. There are our parents and children, all those kinds of things. And I think what's useful for us is to reflect on the fact that even though we are not in such a highly, you know, thankfully, in my view, in a such a highly sort of regimented social environment, we do have very concrete, particular relationships with different kinds of people we interact with all the time, and that it serves us to pay attention to those. What are my responsibilities and duties with regard to Kazon or Jerry? The word here is filial. It's interesting. I'm telling you, man, I'm just riffing here. This is not, you'll just have to excuse me because I'm going to be jumping around a lot. But the character, the Chinese character for filial is, it's a picture, it's a graph for an old man, and then directly adjoining that below it, one for a child. So you have, you know, obviously in this Confucian context, filiality, you know, this notion of, you know, relationships to children, to parents, and so on and so forth. And that's good, but I think in our current context, our current historical situation, that, you know, where filiality is not part of our worldview in any real sense, that if we think about this idea at all, we sort of reverse the order of that so that we're not thinking about what we owe the people who came before us, although certainly we want to keep that in mind, but that we pay more attention to our responsibilities to the people who will be coming after us, the children, broadly speaking. And I think that this is part of what Taigen is engaged in this weekend, as Roy pointed out in his talk last week. I quoted the fire sermon, Buddhist fire sermon. The world is on fire, the ear is on fire with, you know, greed, hate, and delusion, the fires of greed, hate, and delusion, the eye is on fire, all these things. Sometimes we're instructed to practice as if our hair was on fire. Our hair is on fire. The world is changing very, very quickly and very, very dramatically. As Buddhists, as Zen students, we are called, as ever, to respond. Okay. So that's the first sort of line that I wanted to talk about. And I'll just sum that up. So here we have this poem about samadhi, and we get to the end right before it tells us to practice secretly like a fool and an idiot, and sort of instructs us to do that in the context of our situation vis-a-vis the rest of the world. So Suzuki Roshi has this line, in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and for those of you who are here for the first time today, Suzuki Roshi is Taigen's kind of Dharma grandfather, great-grandfather, depending on how you figure that, teacher kind of thing, and brought this practice to the United States about 50 years ago. He has a book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which most of you are familiar with, and in this book there's a, I mean, it's full of these just sort of like little wonderful little bombs, but this is one of them. He says, he defines Zen, Zazen, the practice we're engaged in, as Hinayana practice with Mahayana spirit. We could say with Bodhisattva spirit, with the spirit of keeping the welfare and dignity of all beings, past and future, in the forefront of our concerns and efforts. So again, there's this, you know, just that way of putting it, Hinayana practice with Mahayana spirit. This, the context of our practice is indicated here by Suzuki Roshi, goes beyond ourselves. So we can look at Hinayana practice, this term Hinayana practice. So historically, Hinayana was a term that sort of emerged in contradistinction to Mahayana, the great vehicle, the great path, the Bodhisattva way, which came a little historically later. And there's no way of avoiding it. Suzuki Roshi uses the term here, and so I quote him, but it's basically a term that we should forget, at least insofar as historically there's been a tendency to apply this to the Southern Asian traditions, that what we know today as the Theravada traditions, which are perceived as sort of not the Bodhisattva path, but a path that sort of focuses on, you know, self-liberation and cultivation. You know, and there's elements of truth to that, but there's no, in what I'm saying here, I want to distance it from that kind of sense, as applying to a particular style of Buddhism or a particular school of Buddhism. It does apply to a particular style of Buddhism in the sense that you know, there are kinds of practice that are very much, you know, concerned with just ourselves, with our own sort of cultivation, our own peace, our own development, and so on. But that can appear just as easily in this Zendo as anywhere else in the, you know, any other place in the world. It's a problem of practice. It's not a school of practice. And in, so we could call it selfish practice. It's practice that doesn't see what we're doing as in relationship to all other beings. And consequently, it, by its very nature, it sort of reinscribes the very sort of problem that the Buddha was at such pains to try to wake us up to, which is this idea of being a separate self, this failure to see the truth of non-separation, of emptiness. And so, yeah, so I just want to point that out. We have these two instances where, in essence, two great teachers, Suzuki Roshi and Dongshan, are sort of suggesting that, you know, this practice isn't just about you. We have... filial responsibilities. We have responsibilities not only to the people that we are sort of directly involved with, people of the present day. We have responsibilities as well to the past, and we have responsibilities to those who come after us. When we look at it, it seems like almost everything in the Buddhist, in the way the teachings are laid out, sort of hit this point home again and again and again. but it's easy to miss somehow. And there are things in our own way of going about it that sort of supports our failure to sort of see this. I mean, a very clear example is, you know, we call ourselves Zen Buddhists. We call ourselves meditation Buddhists. And it sort of privileges, and in a way, completely appropriately, centralizes this practice of meditation that we're doing. It's key. But it has to be appreciated within the context of the wider Buddhist path, which also includes, I mean, one way of schematizing it is it's not only meditation, it's also precepts, shila, you know, ethics and wisdom. Now, with the ethical part of it, you know, the precepts and then all these sort of associated teachings like the paramita, such things as generosity, patience, energy, all these things very sort of clearly are, you know, they orient us to our interactions with others. You know, those, there, I mean, there's this, you know, right in the heart of the, you know, the enunciation of the Eightfold Path makes it perfectly clear that our Zazen practice is not simply or exclusively about self-cultivation. Also, you know, the first two steps of those of that path, you know, right view and right intention, you know, which in the sort of scheme of things are usually, you know, sometimes the Eightfold Path is broken down into as corresponding to these different parts of the Eightfold Path is corresponding to these different, you know, aspects, meditation, ethics, and wisdom. But these first two, right view and right intention, that sort of schema relate to prajna. And you know, right view, it has to do with understanding sort of the lack of own being of all things, including ourselves, impermanence and dukkha. So it's sort of like the cognitive part of wisdom. And then right intention, you know, has to do with sort of the volitional aspect of prajna. You know, so it's essentially commitment to ethical and mental sort of self-development and finding a way to actually enact, you know, wisdom and compassion in the world. So, and this is, well, we'll get back to that. But so right at the, you know, right at the start of the Eightfold Path, we see this sort of pointing, not really outward, we can't say outward because it's not this against that, but it sort of indicates this kind of inclusive view that takes in much more than just the person sitting on their mats and cushions. And you know, so you know, the Eightfold Path precepts say, and wisdom, you know, have that aspect, you know, very readily apparent. It's maybe harder to see how the practice of samadhi, the practice of zazen, has that inclusive quality in some ways. Because when we sit down on our mats and cushions, immediately what we're presented with is, you know, thoughts, reactions, feelings, all this stuff that are, you know, seen somehow to be mine. And it's very easy to, in our zazen, as we pay attention to this, to let the rest of the world drop away or seem to drop away. And in a way, that's fine. In a way, that's absolutely really not quite what is happening. But But yeah, it's hard to see Zazen as a harder to see Zazen as a kind of a inclusive activity. I don't know quite how to talk about this, but the point is that the point of samadhi is not really just about how we are in our own hearts and minds when we sit on our cushions. At the end of the day, it's not even about our private experience. It has to do with how we actually live out our lives with other beings, you know, both human and otherwise. So, and as we saw before, this is the domain of precepts and discipline, Shila, and so on and so forth. So there's really no there's no separation between this aspect of Zazen and this aspect of enlightened, awake sort of engagement, bodhisattvic relationship with the world, and the assumption of our responsibilities, or at least assumption of the burden of trying to think through and relate, to identify what our, how we should actually be in the world. They're not separate, and therefore, when Suzuki Roshi says, Hinayana practice with Mahayana spirit, it's the Hinayana, as he means it here, the sort of narrow way that he's talking about is absolutely essential. I mean, the general way of the world is to sort of engage in the world, but without that aspect of samadhi, and we get confused and boxed up. We have a world of woes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in practice, we, rather than do that, we step back, we sit on our mats and cushions on a regular basis. We fully witness and appreciate the unfolding of greed, hate, delusion, both in ourselves and the world. And we, then go out and live our lives, which is also not separate from Zazen itself. But so the Hinayana part, the very narrow way, the discipline of sitting on your mats and cushions, the discipline of very sort of concretely engaging with the precepts, sort of actively, like, how do I support all beings? How do I not kill? It's very important to involve ourselves with that. But at the same time, it's also important to realize that, that kind of Hinayana practice, that kind of narrow disciplined practice, is always not simply for ourselves, not for itself. It's always pointing to this bigger picture, in the Bodhisattva way anyway, this bigger picture of compassionate, active engagement with other beings, because other beings are not, in a way, other beings. And I think that this is part of what Taigen's absence today kind of alerts us to, that this is not to say that everybody needs to do things in the same way. It is not to say that everybody has to agree with Taigen's politics, because those are right and somebody else's are wrong. They may be. It's none of that. But what I'm trying to do is sort of invite you to see your practice, all of your practice, in a very broad scheme, and to see it as, in a way, I just said your practice, to see it as not your practice. It's because it's not so localized. It is really practice for all beings. The Zen way is part of the Bodhisattva way, and we'll be chanting the Bodhisattva vows later. But that's the context, you know, that I would encourage you to sort of think about your zazen in. Even when we're, you know, when we're sitting down by ourselves at home, in a very real sense, as Taigen says, even, you know, by ourselves in a room, we are sitting with all beings. And it's good to sort of keep that in mind. So that's pretty disjointed, but there you go. And I invite any comments and encourage any people have disagreements. I encourage them to express them, or any corrections, and so on and so forth. So thanks.
Just started reading, I think it's the latest book by E.L. Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And,
what's it called?
Something about the evolution of social behavior. That's not exact. Sorry.
Okay.
And it's very much guided by his concern about all the beings, all life on Earth. But one of the things he says that I thought was really amazing, is that we have space age intellect ruled by stone age emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that really connects with what you're saying, because by sitting and being aware of all those stone age emotions and impulses, we can be less ruled by them.
Yeah.
And so that can help us to behave in ways that are better for all beings.
This has to do with the, you know, so Taigen often talks about the attention itself having sort of a transformative quality. It's like, and that's part of what happens when we sit here. We actually see our caveman sort of being in a way that we don't otherwise have a chance to do, and that actually brings it along. You know, we start to see the limitations of that, and it naturally sort of changes. We don't have to suppress it. We don't have to kill it. We don't have to be mad at it. But if we see it and engage with it, it can grow up a little bit. Roy.
Yeah, I may disagree with that quote a little bit.
With the quote?
The quote. Because, yes, we live in a space-age technology, but I think saying that we address it with stone-age emotions is an insult to the Stone Age. In that, you know, in the Stone Age, you knew what, you know, whatever your life was, that was it. I think we have a much greater ability to distract ourselves and not deal with things as they come up. And it seems like a lot of what we're doing here is very much Stone Age technology. That we're just sitting, we're paying attention, addressing those things, and without the distractions that let us avoid those emotions. But I think in talking about how we deal so that it's not just for us, I think the start of that is to look at ourselves and to, you know, realize, because there's so many people who say, well, I'm part of the community, you know, I go to church, I do my job, you know, I'm there for everybody else. And then they get really upset, why hasn't everybody made me happy yet? You know, look at all I'm doing for you.
Yeah.
And I think that the less we do for others and do for ourselves, the more we can actually be there for others, because we resolve those own internal issues enough to get out of our own way to be there and present with others.
Jerry?
Part of when you, there's some sense when you realize that sitting and doing other things is really the same thing. So whether you're sitting in Zazen or chopping tomatoes or mowing your lawn, It's all the same thing. It's all a meditative practice. But it's sort of what I'm getting from what you're saying is that if you think of it in reverse, that somehow through the sitting when you're acting, it's not you chopping tomatoes or not you mowing your lawn. And somehow when you think about acting in the world with the basis of that samadhi, it takes the ego out of your action. It takes the sense of, I'm doing this, look at me, isn't this great? Because it's like sitting. You know, there isn't, you're not really there when you're sitting, you're not really there when you're acting. But it sort of gives you some freedom to act without being selfish about it, without being separate about it. It makes your actions as much as you're sitting, just, that's just, it's just flowing along here. And there's not a you acting, just like there's not a you sitting, if you sort of reverse the view.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I agree with what you're saying about how everything can, at least theoretically, I do not claim to sort of experience this myself all the time, but everything can become zazen. But for most of us, it's also true that can't happen for most of us before we do actual sort of zazen, sitting on the mat and cushions. It's a, sort of a starting point. Eventually you want to, whatever's happening here, you want to be able to take with you everywhere.
I just wanted to say that I like that you brought up the obey and the filial, because I vote, because who likes to obey?
Yeah.
I never did. And it was always kind of strange, like, reading that.
It's a tough line for me.
Yeah, and then you get there, and I'm like, yeah, I know, I always kind of... But, and I remember just recently... council or some committee or something. Like, do you have to always obey the teacher? Like, do you always have to just bow and, like, do, you know, or can you say, you know, can you question? I mean, the Buddha wants you to question, you know, like, question, I think. And so I'm glad that you brought that up. I appreciate that.
No, yeah, you're welcome. I mean, it's interesting because in the context of working with a teacher, you know, I think there is a sense that they, in fact, do likely know better than you, and that's not to say that you can't question, you can't challenge, but it is a situation in which you, being filial, might be the way to go. But you know, that's a very special relationship, and you know, the trouble I have with this line is that it sort of like says, well, you know. You know, one of your basic tasks here is to obey, which makes it sound like, you know, I mean, outside of that special relationship, like there are other people out there who know better or sort of more authoritatively than you. While humility is always very important, in terms of what goes on in the world, you know, say, in terms of, like, when somebody, you know, decides they want to have a war or something, it's like, you know, no. In fact, you know, you can't take it for granted that they know better than you, and all those people who sort of opposed, you know, our recent wars, in my view, turned out to be sort of vindicated. So this thing as a general sort of... response to the world, obey, doesn't work so well for me anymore. And I don't feel like I can sort of let myself off the hook of thinking things through for myself. On the other hand, you know, Taigen makes suggestions about my practice. That's a much more concrete thing, and the likelihood is I will listen to him very carefully.
Thank you.
Douglas.
I think your point about how the statement about ministers serve their lords and children obey their parents, you know, is coming up in a Confucian setting. And I think Dongshan's real point is Zen students frequently either seek for some, you know, this opening up in which somehow it's all the same, we're all one sort of thing. And Dongshan, the precious mirror samadhi, is all about saying, no, that's really not it. It opens up this image of how snow in a silver bowl or a heron lost in the moonlight, you know, they're similar. Those are pretty traditional Zen images of it. It's all, you know, it's all of one taste. It's all related, all the same. But he says, no, they're similar, but they're different. And throughout the poem, he keeps coming back to, you have to be, there's specifics. You can appreciate a wide open territory, but we walk on roads, and when our inverted thinking stops, we naturally accord with what's real. So that we it's not just the same. We accord. There's a relationship, and we respond appropriately to relationships. And I think that's what he's saying. That we, it's not all the same. We're just not walking through a world of oatmeal or something. There are differences, and we have to respond appropriately to the specifics of the situation in our relationship with others.
Absolutely.
And we're always in relationship with something. So the interesting thing, I think, about our zazen is, you know, we sit, and the mind goes on, and we open up to this relationship that we're sitting in. This moment and all the things going on in the moment, we have the rest of our life. When we stand up, we have to do the same thing, respond to conditions, and that's where we have that intimacy with the world, is in response, stepping outside of the topsy-turvy mind.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. You know, sometimes Taigen talks about getting stuck in emptiness, right, or getting stuck in oneness as a potential danger to Zen students. And yeah, I think, and you know, what this poem is broadly about, it I think has to do with this sort of dialectic between, as our other great teaching poem, the Harmony of Difference and Sameness. It has to do with difference and sameness, and neither one of those is privileged. Oneness, or whatever you call it, the universal, is absolutely dependent on Douglas and Yozan, right? In a way, as much as we are dependent on it, difference and sameness arise together. It's getting a little obscure, but
yeah, I think for us, you know, I think Taigen's example is a good one for us, that as we practice and we at least theoretically open up and become aware of the world and the others we're in a relationship, which as how society has developed, that's a wider and wider world of people we are in a relationship with. We're called to respond, and there can be different ways to respond in disagreement about that. The question for me is always that all these poems were written by people who sat in monasteries and spent 12 hours a day on a cushion and didn't have a whole lot of time to interact with the world. What's going on with that? anyway, though, just leave it there.
Okay. Did you have something?
Yeah, I did. And I had something to say that's very related to what Douglas just said. And John Cage said once that in any encounter, it's not clear who's going to be the teacher and who's going to be the student. And he quoted one of his teacher's books, a book by Schoenberg, that said, I learned this book from my students. I think that Taigen has definitely learned from us. You know, he hasn't always been the teacher, he's been a student too. And, you know, you can see how Taigen has changed over the years, partly in response to what he's learned from us. So that's part of that responsiveness in the relationship that Douglas was talking about.
Yeah. Keisa?
Just to add to both of those points, I think the Zen tradition and the teaching stories, the koans that kind of constitute the heart of the literature of our tradition, exemplifies that really well. You know, the teacher-student dialectic going back and forth all the time. And the other thing I'd say is that, you know, the monastic tradition out of which our tradition arises, you know, that it's in its golden, in its golden age, we're talking about monasteries of 5,000 monastic people who are working for their labors. Basically, these are large communities, little cities that were quite complex, I have a feeling, socially. And they pulled these in 12 hours of labor throughout the year, but only during practice period. So I think that it's not so far off. For myself, I quite honestly said, I think we live in the monastery of our own, you know, our own communities, and I'm not sure it's so different from those monks living in those big old monasteries in China in the 8th century.
Well, it's 11 o'clock. Maybe if there's one more comment, we could do it. Otherwise, we'll wrap. Kathy?
Just, it brings back memories of when I used to be in another class and where we studied Lhotse, and Lhotse reacted to Confucianism. And mm-hmm. Confucianism, you know, that, so there's there was an evolution, and that there was more conformity then. And the movement after was kind of seeing the Confucian period as too conformist. But when you think about that word gray, you know, it's like, I think in that time, I wonder if it was maybe used in a different way to refer to the rules, you know, like don't kill people and don't throw your garbage here or there or whatever. Mm. And that but that, you know, we have trouble with the word obey, I think partly because we're in such an individualistic society. And I'm not trying to say that we should obey without thinking, not at all. But that I think we automatically move to thoughts of, you're not going to tell me what to do. thinking because it's so much part of us in different ways. And so, you know, I just wonder, you know, in terms of the historical context, how obey was thought of. It does raise that, and how it shifted over the centuries.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really funny. I mean, it's interesting to hear people. I mean, apparently, I'm not the first one to sort of like bump up against those lines. And I, you know, a lot of it's, you know, sort of historically contextual or whatever. And you know, obviously, we respond to these words in different times, but it's like, you know, it's very funny. It's like, you know, man, I just really love my mom, you know, and I'd do anything for my mom. But, you know, somebody tells me I should be filial. You know, that's kind of like, what? What do you mean I should be filial? You know, it's weird. Anyway. Anything else? Yeah.
I was going to say, like, sometimes in a practice, if my mind veers off, like a cough or like when the bell rings to bring it back to my practice, I kind of hope that as Buddhists in the world, when we see things that we have a problem with in our heart, that it will also bring us back to the world. Because especially right now in Chicago, we have all this bloodshed in the South Side. We live in a very segregated community as a city. So I'm hoping that as Buddhists, we can wake up to our city soon.
Great. That's great. Thank you.